Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. First hour of our program today, the president gave his address yesterday about the budget and about preservation of certain programs in this country. So now we have an Obama plan and a Ryan plan, and we're going to talk about both of them the first hour of our program. The president said, "Let me be absolutely clear, I will preserve these health care programs," and he was referring to Medicare and Medicaid, "as a promise that we make to each other in this society. I will not allow Medicare to become a voucher program that leaves seniors at the mercy of the insurance industry with a shrinking benefit to pay for rising costs. I will not tell families with children who have disabilities that they have to fend for themselves. We will reform these programs, but we will not abandon the fundamental commitment this country has kept for generations." The speech was titled by some, "The Country That I Believe In, That Obama Believes In." And we'll talk about his deficit reduction plan, Ryan's deficit reduction plan, and what your thoughts are about both of them. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We'll have two guests with different perspectives the first hour of the program. Kevin Hassett is joining us, Senior Fellow and Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He was a senior economist at the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System and an associate professor of economics and finance at the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University, also a policy consultant to the Treasury Department during the George Herbert Walker Bush and Clinton administrations. He served as John McCain's chief economic advisor during the 2000 presidential primaries and served as a senior economic advisor to the McCain 2008 presidential campaign. He is a columnist for National Review. Later this hour, Dean Baker will join us, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of several books, including Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. And we start with Kevin Hassett. Hello, Kevin. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for being here. It's great to be here and to be here before Dean, who's actually a co-author of mine, even though we almost never agree.
But you get along, and that's good.
Right.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, we couldn't have two more different visions, I think, of where the country should go in terms of what our priorities are. Do you think there's a vast difference between the Ryan plan and the Obama plan?
I think there's a smaller difference than you might think. I'd have to say that the president kicked off the negotiation with this remarkably uncollegial gesture. You know, he invited Paul Ryan and Jeb Hensarling, and I guess Cantor was the other one, to come sit there while he gave the speech. And then he accused them of you know, being willing to float people with Down syndrome out on an iceberg, which is just like really a heinous misrepresentation of their plan. And so when you see stuff like that, you think, oh my gosh, we're doomed. They're never going to be able to act like adults. But then if you actually look at the details, you can see that there's a lot of room for negotiation.
What's the room for negotiation?
Okay, well, first of all, I think that the fact is that the big money is in Medicare and Medicaid, mm-hmm. and I think that they've both put those on the table. The other thing is that the president talked about a trigger. He calls it a debt fail-safe trigger. And the idea would be that if we're not making progress on the deficit, then we start reducing everything across the board, and or maybe almost everything across the board. And the debt trigger is another idea that I think that people on the left and the right can agree on. If we don't get to a sustainable path, then the debt trigger or something that would more or less guarantee that we would get there.
The big difference seems to me to be in health care programs. The president mm-hmm. said, and I quoted at the beginning, let me be absolutely clear, that he would preserve those programs as a promise that we make to each other in this society. He really laid out a vision of how we ought to take care of each other. I will not allow Medicare, he said, to become a voucher program.
Right. So he said that we would preserve the programs, but he didn't say how, and he didn't mention that Ryan would preserve them too. It's just that he would transform them so that they could actually sustain themselves and put us on a sustainable path. So, for example, let's think about Medicaid. So what Ryan does for Medicaid is that rather than having the current system where states can do whatever they want and then mail a big chunk of the bill to the federal government, which gives states little incentive to watch the growth of costs. He blocked grants to the states the amount of money they're getting today, and then just grows it a little bit slower than is projected by the CBO, but says to the states, you know, figure out, innovate, work out a program that satisfies what you want to do. So unless you think that the states themselves are gonna you know, give up the obligation to the poor, which I think none of them would, then the Ryan plan allows for some innovation. And similarly with Medicare, what Ryan wants to do is give people something like $15,000 to buy a health insurance plan, and then grow that over time at a rate that would, you know, challenge the innovation or the innovativeness of insurers. But what would happen in that framework would be there'd be a whole bunch of insurers competing to offer an insurance plan to the elderly, and the elderly would choose the one that they like the best, and so the market would work for them. Obama's plan in both cases is to have this massive bureaucracy in the federal government, you know, decide, you know, on fixing prices and saying that we'll cover this but we won't cover that, and really centralizing the whole thing. And so there is a fundamentally different vision on how to constrain costs, but the good news is that they both are proposing that we constrain the cost.
Mm-hmm. The president really outlined his vision of what it meant for him to be a Democrat, what he was going to hold fast to. Mm-hmm. And he spoke, some would say he's running for president now, and this was mm-hmm. the first of a strong campaign speech trying to shore up his base, the progressives who have been concerned about some of his policies. Did you see it as such? And do you believe that he has wavered certainly on tax extension for breaks for the wealthy in the past few months? He's now saying that he won't do that. Did you see him espousing a philosophy that will carry him into a campaign that he will hold fast to?
I think that what he's doing now is he's trying to make it seem like Paul Ryan wants to, you know, starve babies and deny health care to the elderly and stuff. But if you look at Ryan's proposal, it really doesn't do that. That's really unfair. And so what he's doing is he's running back to kind of like the old Democratic playbook that whenever Republicans propose any change to these entitlements, which are broken, then they accuse them of being mass murderers. And really, his rhetoric was just about that bad. I mean, I found it deeply offensive, as did Paul Ryan, if you look at what he said after the speech. And so he's playing that political game, but that political game is why we've got a broken system. And so he's setting us up to do nothing, I would guess, with that rhetoric. And it's really unfortunate because when he's saying, oh, well, you know, we've got to take care of the poor people, that's what Democrats think and Republicans don't think, that's just false. That's just false. I mean, Ryan's plan does, you know, a really clever job of taking care of those people and doing it in a way that allows, you know, flexibility in how healthcare is provided and so on. And so I would say that if there is a theology in Obama's address yesterday, it's basically economic illiteracy. I mean, he's basically saying that we can have a big centrally planned healthcare system in the U.S. and that will do a lot better than giving people money to buy insurance on their own. And again, think about it this way. If we did set up a system, a voucher system, where people could buy health insurance on their own, then they could definitely afford to get health insurance like your plan that you have right now. And so, I mean, it's like $15,000 is a lot of money every year. If we set up a plan where people can buy health insurance on their own, and then we find that there, you know, are some cracks that are opening, well, then we can increase the amount of money in the voucher, right? We can change if we observe that those things happen. And so to require that, you know, basically Washington dictate on high every detail, right down to the prices of what's going on in the healthcare system, I think it's economically illiterate. And it's the system, if that's the system that the Democrats want to defend, then I think that they're going to be rejected just like they were in the last election.
Kevin, what about his comments that the Republicans have never been in favor of programs like Medicare and Social Security? He went on about mm-hmm. that at some length, saying that this is an idea that they have opposed it. They don't believe that the government should be in the business of taking care of, you know, people when they retire, mm-hmm. or government should be involved in medical care. Is that true? Was he talking about some
truth
here?
No, that's not true. And that's not true. I mean, there's been a difference of opinion about, you know, how much people should be covered and so on. But the notion that Republicans want to starve the widows and orphans is just politics. And he knows that. I mean, if you just look at the Republicans that have voted over time for things like the prescription drug plan and so on, I mean, that was President Bush that introduced it. I mean, there's a lot of activity in the Republican Party on this. I think that the difference is that the Republicans are economically literate and the Democrats aren't. The Democrats think that incentives don't matter and that central planning is the way to fix all of our problems.
Isn't it a political risk, though, for Republicans to change Medicare significantly? This is, all indications are, quite a popular program.
I think that it's absolutely the case that it's a political risk, and that really I think that what we're going through right now is a very interesting moment in American history, because what Paul Ryan did, really for the first time in American politics, I think if we go back and look at budgets, at least in my lifetime, is that he took on the sacred cows, he touched the third rail, and you know, he set it up so that the Democrats could either say, okay, well, we don't like all of your solutions, but we understand that the U.S. is on a course to default and we have to do something about it, and so let's start talking. Or they could say, well, you know, these guys are going to try to kill the widows and orphans. They're starving the babies, and then try to gain political momentum. The reason why I think it's a crucial moment in American history is that there's a question now, will the Democrats' rhetoric appeal to Americans, or are Americans going to say, hey, you know what, the U.S.'s present value deficit, if we don't change our programs, is something like $100 trillion. You know, our debt to GDP is above that for most countries in the year that they lost their AAA rating. And we think that is just unacceptable, and we want our politicians to fix it. And I think that if Obama gets a lot of traction and he starts going up in the polls with this demonization of Paul Ryan and the Republicans, then we're going to basically have the same old, same old. But if, on the other hand, Americans reject it, then, you know, I think reluctantly what's going to happen is Democrats will go to the table. The odd thing is that I think that if you examine the politics of it, that if President Obama were to sort of sit down collegially and legislate with Paul Ryan, that he'd almost certainly be guaranteed to win when he runs for re-election, because the sort of assertion that he's this big government socialist would be totally off the table. And by choosing to demonize Republicans, as he did in the speech yesterday, I think that he set himself up for a much more difficult run for the presidency.
Let's talk about taxes for a moment before mm-hmm. we go to our phone banks, because they're all filled. Mm-hmm. He did say pretty forcefully as I've heard him say this, although we could look at what he said when he was campaigning some years ago, that he would he made a case for, we need to tax those who are in the upper 1%, who are making quite a bit of money, and he really indicated that probably he would veto a bill that allowed those tax rates to continue for the highest income where they are now.
Isn't it funny, though, that with the Democrats having, you know, historically large majorities, especially in the Senate, having a supermajority in the Senate and control of the White House, that they had 2 years to resolve this tax issue by extending the tax cuts in at the bottom, but not those at the top. Mm-hmm. But they didn't do so. And I think that the reason is that when you're lifting only the top rate, then one, there's not a lot of revenue there, because I mean, I think that their estimate for the latest one is something like $300 million over 10, which, given that, you know, that's not even putting a dent in the annual deficit, and it's very large. But the second thing is that those are the small businesses and so on that can create jobs, and so I think there are very sound arguments that it's a much better idea to if you want to get more revenue out of the tax code, to broaden the base by, you know, eliminating deductions and so on, than it is to lift the top rate. And so I think there are a lot of Democrats who don't believe that the right policy is what the president's espousing. And if there weren't, then it would have changed already, right? Because they had enough power in Congress to do exactly what he wanted, but were unable to.
You're saying that we would only get $300 million more dollars if we taxed
$300 billion.
$300 billion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought
that's something like that.
That seemed a little low.
Yeah.
Let's go to phone calls. We have many. Our guest this hour is Kevin. Not this half hour. First half hour is Kevin Hassett. He is a senior fellow and director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, and he served as policy consultant to the Treasury Department during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration and Clinton administrations, and was a senior economic advisor to the McCain 2008 presidential campaign. Number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Pat in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm mainly just hitting on the credibility of your guest today. The economic illiteracy he liked to keep calling the Democrats. The bank system shows it's economic illiterate, and that's the principal economic, you know, entity in America. And if that's fought tooth and nail by the Republicans to continue to leave it as is. And it was bailed out by the poor, the hungry, starving orphans and their mothers. It was bailed out by those people. And this gentleman has the nerve to call the Democrats economically illiterate. Democrats are in general, let's take care of everyone. And Republicans are, even if you don't have boots, like a lot of people in America don't have right now, let's have those people without boots pull them up by them, their bootstraps. This gentleman is a white man. Very, very. He doesn't realize how grateful he is. And he's supposedly a Christian, and he probably is
also... Let's not get into his religious beliefs. What do you have to say about his presentation of very different philosophies, Kevin?
Oh, well, you know, I think that there's no question that the president's position is that incentives don't matter. And I think that economics is about how incentives affect things. And if you look at his solution to Medicare and Medicaid, the very first thing, go to the White House website, whitehouse.gov, and look at their big press advisory about the president's proposal yesterday. And in the president's proposal, the very first thing that they mention in the sort of solution for fixing Medicare and Medicaid is that they're going to increase the strength of something that they call the Independent Payment Advisory Board. The Independent Payment Advisory Board is the thing that, you know, looks for ways to cut costs for Medicare and Medicaid basically by dictating prices. And so what we're doing is we're putting in a very strong central planner in Medicare and Medicaid in order to, you know, quote unquote, preserve Medicare and Medicaid the way that they currently work. But you're not going to be able to do that without rationing and introducing all sorts of distortions, because we know, I mean, look at the Soviet Union, that central planning just doesn't work. The alternative that Paul Ryan has proposed is not, starving babies and taking away people's boots. It's just saying, let's let people buy insurance. And then the insurance companies have to compete for their business by offering them plans, maybe with deductibles, maybe they cover some things and not others, and so on. If you don't like the decision that an insurance company makes about what it's going to cover and what it's not going to cover, then you can go to a different insurance policy. Under Obama's plan, what's going to happen is there's going to be one big national policy, and they're going to try to make it cost-effective by fixing prices and rationing care. And I just think that it's an inferior approach, and it's one that's not really consistent with the lessons of economics.
The Ryan plan has been criticized for not realizing how rapidly healthcare costs are going up, so that there isn't enough leeway to give people more money when you're looking at a huge rate of inflation to care for healthcare year by year.
I think that, you know, the Ryan plan and the Obama plan both slow the growth of spending a lot, way below where it's been on the Medicare and Medicaid. And so then the question is, can we accomplish that while maintaining care? And what I'm saying is that I have a lot more faith that if we allow sort of competition insurance markets between insurance companies where they're allowed, you know, X amount of dollars for a premium, that path is going to lead to superior care than to the path where the government is like providing a monopoly plan with price setting and quantity rationing and so on. And so I don't know. I think that if you think about most of the people who aren't senior citizens that are listening and are fortunate enough to have health insurance, you know, they have a plan that's paid for by their employer that's negotiated every year the terms of it, that has things like deductibles that make it so that, you know, they have a little bit of skin in the game when they decide to seek medical care. So maybe they tend to want to do it only when they really need it. that type of a plan, if you think that that's unacceptable, it's okay for you, but it's unacceptable for seniors, then you're with President Obama, but you're not with me. And frankly, I think that if you do start to have incentives where there are deductibles and so on, that disincent people from seeking care unless they need it, or makes them have a little bit of skin in the game when they seek care, then you're likely to have an impact on costs. If you look at the impact of Obamacare, or RomneyCare in Massachusetts, which is really the model for Obamacare, you can see that what happens when you sort of make insurance universally available and then don't really put any marginal costs on people that can afford it, at least, then you get a huge increase in the demand for health care, because it's basically it becomes free. That's sort of what's already happened with seniors, but in Massachusetts, it's really stunning. You know, now because there's been this big increase in demand for health care, you have to wait something like 55 days to see your doctor, and visits to emergency rooms are actually up since RomneyCare was introduced, and RomneyCare was supposed to reduce visits to emergency rooms, and they're up because people no longer worry about whether they have to pay anything when they go to the doctor, and it takes so long to see a doctor in his office because the demand is really outstripping supply. And so anyway, I think you have to get incentives into the healthcare system, but obviously be attentive to giving incentives to people who can afford it. My favorite way to do it, just to give you an idea of the kind of thing that could happen, is imagine if today we gave every senior an extra $1,000 in their Social Security, but then told them that if they go to the doctor, then their Medicare will cover all expenses after the first $1,000. Then you've given the people the resources they need to spend it if they need to, but you've also made them think a little bit about when they go and when they don't go. And that's the kind of incentive change that Republicans are seeking and Democrats aren't.
Scott in Green Bay, hi.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I do have just a couple of quick comments about it. If we do raise the tax rates, what we've lost by not raising them is $800 billion over 10 years, and that's $80 billion a year. That's with a $1.5 trillion deficit, that's an accounting error. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm just saying raising the taxes on the rich is all about one thing, making other people feel good. You know, the name-calling that goes on by the Democrats saying that the Republicans basically are going to kill people with their budget, that's got to stop. And I really wish the press would push them on that and point that out. You've really got to stop saying we're actually going to kill people with it. What was really interesting is Obama's philosophy. And one of the things that I caught in the speech was how he thinks. He thinks what made this country great, and he said this, what makes this country great is government entitlement. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, he said, are what makes this country great. And that is how this president thinks, because I don't think those things make us great. And my final point is, if we want to go back to the Clinton tax rates, let's go back to the Clinton budget. It was $1.8 trillion Clinton's last year. Obama's doubled that budget. We're up to $3.5 trillion.
Well, obviously, I agree a lot with the caller. I think that the interesting challenge is to think about why it is that someone can say what you said and say the things that I said, and then people like the previous caller will be so enraged by it. There's clearly a communication failure that, you know, absolutely, you know, Republicans have to bear some blame for that. So Paul Ryan, you know, can say that he cares about you know, poor people and seniors and wants to guarantee those programs for them, but there's a big chunk of America that just doesn't believe them, and I think it's interesting to muse about why that might be.
Let's take one more phone call, and it will be Sarah in Zion, and then we switch guests. Same topic, everybody. Your calls still apply. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi, Sarah.
Okay. You know, I think that to say that a private health care system would eventually offer superior care to seniors is just fantasy, because, first of all, seniors are the most risky population, and I don't see insurance companies rushing in to compete for their business. And in order for them to make a profit off of them, they'd have to deny certain services, certain care. And so I think that would result in a higher death rate among people who would be put on that kind of program. And so I don't think it is hyperbole to say that people would die. Some people will die because they wouldn't be able to get the services, the treatment they need. And also, I mean, it seems like your guest has a philosophy that health care should be, I mean, obviously he believes that health care should be part of the market system, and that people should not seek health care as often as they do, which, I mean, in that philosophy of health care, you're not going to get the treatment you need sometimes in order for the insurance companies to make their profits. So.
Kevin.
I think that if there's an insurance policy out there that is going to deny people the health care they need in a crisis, then people won't buy that policy. And, you know, make no mistake about it, that I can remember I had cancer a while ago. I had lymphoma, and I looked at the treatment in the U.S., the available to people in the U.S. and the treatment in Europe. And basically, I had about a 5% higher chance of surviving, which thankfully I did. Because the treatment in the U.S., which was covered by my insurer, involved things that were more costly that in Europe they basically wouldn't let you do. So the fact is that when there's a government monopoly deciding what they're going to pay for and what they're not going to pay for, and it's really the centerpiece of Obama's budget saving, is that this board is going to start to make decisions on cost effectiveness and prices, then that's where constraints come in. So I, for example, would rather be in a system like the one I said, where we give you $1,000 in Social Security and then make you pay the first $1,000 out of pocket when you have a health event. I'd rather be in a system that has a deductible but covers the big things when I need them, than to be in a system that provides insurance the first minute that I need health care, but then starts to quantity ration me on the other end. And I think that obviously if everybody's spending the same amount of dollars, then there are going to be choices about how to do that. And it looks like to me that the Democrats are making choices that aren't the ones that I would prefer and that most Americans would prefer.
And finally, again, getting back to this philosophy, the president talked about there but for the grace of God go I, and said, specifically mentioned Social Security, unemployment insurance, Medicaid, and Medicare. We are a better country because of these commitments.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. Yeah, that's true. And I think most Republicans, almost all Republicans, would agree with that.
Okay.
I mean, they would like to do it better. Again, maybe voucherize things, give block grants to the states to run Medicaid so that their incentives are aligned correctly. But the basic objective of making sure that every American has access to health care and that people, aren't in poverty in retirement is one that's shared by all.
Thanks, Kevin, very much. Glad
Thanks.
You're healthy again.
It's been
Thank
a
you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Kevin Hassett, Senior Fellow and Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He has spent a long time advising presidents and was Senator John McCain's chief economic advisor during the 2000 presidential primaries and during the 2008 presidential campaign, and has worked in the Treasury, policy consultant to the Treasury during the George Herbert Walker Bush administrations and the Clinton administration. We are continuing our conversation. We now have two very different plans on the table for how to deal with the deficit and what vision our country should take when it comes to health care, when it comes to taxes, pretty major policy addresses given by the president yesterday at George Washington University and given by Congressman Paul Ryan last week. So we're talking about the meat of what they have given to us in the ensuing debate. Our guest now is Dean Baker, and Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. He writes a column for The Guardian, Unlimited, The Huffington Post, and his blog is Beat the Press, which features commentary on economic reporting. He's written a number of books. He worked as a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute and an assistant professor at Bucknell University. He's worked as a consultant for the World Bank, the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress, and was author of the weekly online commentary on economic reporting, the Economic Reporting Review. We'll continue to take phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we thank you very much, Dean, for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
The president held pretty fast on continuing a Medicare program and also on saying no to an extension of tax cuts for the wealthy. He was pretty strong yesterday, wasn't he?
Well, I was certainly, it was certainly a lot stronger than I'd expected or had been worried about, because there was a lot of pressure here in Washington for him to make major concessions on Social Security, on Medicare, to really cut back those programs, which, of course, in the case of Social Security, it's not a source of the budget deficit at all. In the case of Medicare, this is an essential program that you know, people really depend on. And, of course, the problem with Medicare is not the program. The problem is private sector health care costs. And President Obama, to my mind, said exactly the right things on that. So he stood behind those programs, and he said what, you know, I think it's just kind of common sense, that insofar as we need more revenue, the people who have been doing well should be the ones who pay it. And the idea of giving further tax breaks to the wealthiest, as Representative Ryan has proposed, I think is kind of, you know, crazy in the current context.
Our guest before you, your friend, he said, even though you differ wildly on philosophy, Kevin Hassett, said that the tax cut thing is no big deal. It's really a drop in the bucket. It would only mean an additional maybe $300 billion over a long time period. So it's not worth it.
Well, the two issues here, it would mean a bit more. I mean, we could haggle out some of, I think it depends how you're defining the tax cuts, because there's also the estate tax. But again, we could, let's not get into that. It would mean a bit more than that, I think, by most calculations, Congressional Budget Office estimates. But the other point I was making is that Representative Ryan actually wanted to cut further. So President Obama wanted to go back to the pre-Clinton tax rates, basically let President Bush's tax cut expire. So that would take the top rate to 39.6%. Representative Ryan actually wanted to go the other way. He wanted to lower the top rate to 25%. And this is very big money if you actually were to do that. So we could quibble as to how much is there between the currently, I think it's 36% is the top rate, and 39.6%. Again, I'd probably use a number closer to $500 billion over the next decade. But in any case, that aside, if you're to go the other way and lower it to 25%, you're talking about well over $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm. Everybody would agree that there are problems with, obviously, with health care in this country. There continue to be. What you said is interesting, that the private health sector health care costs are what's creating problems for programs like Medicare. The president didn't outline very fully how he would change Medicare to address those private health care costs, because something needs to be done to keep the system vibrant. What would you suggest that he does? Has he talked about this in the past to keep Medicare strong?
Well, one thing he did actually propose is cutting what Medicare pays for prescription drugs, in fact, using its bargaining power to negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry to pay lower prices. And we do pay close to twice as much as what people pay in Canada and most other countries. So that is an important source of cost saving. The other thing he proposed was just simply putting an absolute cap, saying that Medicare costs can't rise by, per person costs can't rise by more than half a percentage point in excess of inflation, which would be substantially lower than what they're doing today. I would like to see other steps. I mean, one of the things I've thrown out there, and I have some conservatives actually, I won't implicate Kevin in here, but other people work at his organization, the American Enterprise Institute, have agreed with me on this. If you gave people vouchers where they could buy into healthcare systems of other countries, so if someone had a voucher, they could buy into the healthcare system of Canada, Germany, whatever country they might want to live in, move to, rely on their healthcare system, and you split the savings, because those savings are end up being enormous, at least based on the cost projections that we're looking at. And if we can't fix our system, why not let people have the option to buy into others? I mean, you don't force them. You just give them the option, and they could split the savings with the government, and it seems like a win-win to me.
Well, that's interesting. I haven't heard that idea before.
Well, for whatever reason, I always love to raise this with economists, other economists. I go, what's wrong with giving people a choice? Why is this, you know, and people say, well, no one's going to take it, and go, well, I frankly would consider that a pretty good deal, because in a lot of cases you might be giving someone $10,000 a year to go to Spain or Germany to rely on their health care system. I mean, it vary by country, but it would be a substantial sum of money for most retirees. And again, you aren't forcing them. If they don't want to go, they still have the current system here. But I think it would do two things. One is it directly saves money, but the other is that it would put downward pressure on costs here. If more people in the United States were aware that, you know, look, Germany actually has a good healthcare system. This is good, in some ways better than the U.S. system, and they're paying half as much, there'd be a lot of pressure to adopt the same sort of cost-saving techniques that they employ in Germany, Canada, other countries.
So what do you see as a problem with giving people, you know, $15,000, you go on the market when you're a senior and you, because so many insurance companies are going to be competing, you'll get a good deal for your health care costs. You do the negotiating yourself. You find what's best for you. What's wrong with that plan?
Well, we've had experience with this, both within Medicare system and the private insurance system more generally. It doesn't constrain costs. The insurance companies have enormous power in that relationship, as you know, all of us have had to deal with our insurance company know. They really hold the cards, and they've been very ineffective in holding down costs. And you know, we just tried. President Bush put in his Medicare Advantage plan in 2003 that raised costs, not lowered them. Back in the 90s, the Gingrich Congress got their Medicare Plus choice, again, that raised costs, not lower them. And again, when we look at the private sector, it certainly has been no more effective, and in most ways probably less effective than Medicare in keeping down costs. So it's not as though Representative Ryan's proposing something new. We've done this again and again, and it's failed. And it's sort of like, well, are we supposed to keep doing this for all eternity and just watch it fail in one way and then another and say, oh, it's going to work this time?
Let's go to some phone calls and emails. I have a ton of emails, too, left over from the last half hour. This is applicable to you as well. Robin from Madison, this week's Newsweek has an article about Paul Ryan saying that he's an Ayn Rand nut. He admits her philosophy drives his thinking. And the article goes on to delineate how Ryan's proposal reflects a class view in a striking way. The poorest Americans would suffer immediate, explicit budget cuts. Middle Americans would face distant, uncertain reductions. And the richest would enjoy an immediate windfall. Would you please comment on this perspective?
Well, I think that more or less characterizes it. I mean, the reality, what he's proposed is very large cuts in programs like Medicaid, food stamps. Other programs are designed to help low-income people and, you know, almost invariably are going to be big hits to them with Medicare, which, of course, is, you know, the health care program that most of us are expecting to depend on once we, you know, once we turn 65, once we retire. He basically dissolves that program. We're going to be given an $8,000 voucher, and you know we'll go look for insurance on the private market. And again, you know the evidence is that it is not going to be anywhere near enough to pay for a decent health care plan. So I think that story is basically right. And again, he comes back with very large tax cuts. I mean, again, just crude arithmetic. I was looking at the other day because it was in the news. Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, is now getting $20 million a year. Now, I don't know exactly the form that takes, but if that were taxed as ordinary income today, Representative Ryan's tax proposal would, in effect, put another $3 million a year into Lloyd Blankfein's pockets. So, you know, that's more or less what his policy does. I don't, you know, again, Mr. Ryan will have to speak for his own motives, but I think that comment accurately captures what his policy does.
Tom is our first caller for you. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. I work in the hospitals. The hospitals are pretty concerned about what's going on right now. And one comment I have, too, is the Social Security and everything is a debt that's owed by the U.S. government to the people of the United States. They want to default on that at any cost so that they don't have to pay it back. It's like a mortgage. If I defaulted on my mortgage, I'd get called to court, but there's no retribution. Just unelect these guys. The other thing is why aren't the Democrats calling Ryan's plan basically what they did to the Obama plan? Is they're basically sending them to the insurance companies for health care, which are basically the groups that are going to deny care, which is basically the death panels.
Well, good questions. First off, with Social Security, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's not in principle. Congress could vote to default on the debt that is owed to Social Security, the bonds held by Social Security Trust Fund. I think what prevents that is that they know their constituents care hugely about Social Security, and they would be unelected, as you said. So does that provide us with insurance? You know, can we trust Congress? Well, you know, nothing in life is assured, but I think most members of Congress know if they voted to default on the bonds held by a trust fund, they'd probably have to look for a new job pretty quickly. So my personal guess is it's not going to happen, but, you know, it's certainly not impossible. The other question, it's very hard to see how Representative Ryan's plan is consistent with people getting quality care. I know someone made a joke that, You know, they said that under President Obama's plan, you'd have government death panels, whereas under Representative Ryan's plan, you'd have your choice of death panels. You will be denied care. People will not be able to afford good care. And, you know, I was looking at the Congressional Budget Office's projections. It would raise the cost of care. This isn't the redistribution of costs from the government to the individual. It would raise the cost of care if everyone got a Medicare equivalent benefit of $30 trillion over the 75-year planning period for Medicare. That's an amount that's equal to six times the Social Security shortfall that we hear so much about. So that's real money. And what it means is that, well, most people would not be able to afford care. They simply wouldn't be able to pay that sort of money.
Let's go to Marion next in Madison. Hi, Marion.
Hi. I wanted to make a couple of points. One, in terms of the cost and Medicare being inefficient, Medicare runs at about a 10% overhead. And the insurance industry, the health care insurance industry, runs at a 30% overhead. How can we say that the insurance industry is going to be more cost effective? They aren't now. The second point I wanted to make was in controlling health care costs, never do I hear anybody say anything about the corporations of the medical industry, the hospital supply houses, the people who make the lab equipment, the people who make the CAT scanners. They're making billions, and there's no thought to control their costs. We want to just look at the doctors and nurses and control their income. And I feel that if you're going to look at the whole picture, look at everything. You don't keep the capitalist groups off the table just because they happen to be corporations or capitalist and free market entities.
All right, Marion, thank you. Dean.
Kevin was the last half hour.
I remember.
both are very good points. Yes, the overhead costs of insurers, private insurance companies, are much, much larger than Medicare. And again, this is incorporated into Congressional Budget Office projections. So they project right off the bat when you start to replace the traditional Medicare program with the voucher system that Representative Ryan's proposed, from day one, increased costs by 11%. Then on top of that, they project costs would grow more rapidly under Representative Ryan's system than under the current Medicare system. So absolutely, it's a much more efficient system. Now, in terms of constraining costs, well, obviously she hasn't heard me because I have talked about reducing the what we pay to the medical supply companies, the equipment companies, and the drug industry. Not only do we pay them too much, but we pay them the wrong way. The way that drugs and medical supplies, medical technology is developed, You have companies do research, and they do spend a lot of money on research, they get a patent, and then they're allowed to charge exorbitant prices, and it becomes an issue. You're looking at a drug that's a life and death matter, whether you get that drug. Well, if you could afford it or your insurance company afford it, you'll pay $5,000 a year for the drug, or in some cases much, much more than that. What would make much more sense is if you paid for the research up front. We already do this to some extent. The government pays $30 billion a year to finance biomedical research through the National Institutes of Health. I would have them increase that, double that, maybe even a little more, and replace the research funding that's done by the industry now, supported by the patent system. Have it come from the government. It can be done by the private industry and contracted out. I think that would be a good way to go. You could have Pfizer, the same companies, do it. But the point would be everything would be in public domain, both their findings. You can go up on the website and find all the research that they've done, all their results, be available for any doctor, any researcher who's interested. But also the patents would all be in the public domain. And what that would mean is that when we want to get the latest drug, we can go down to a chain drugstore and get it for $5 a prescription, just like a generic. And when it came to this medical equipment, instead of talking about, you know, $5,000 for a scan, you know, using the latest technology, we'd be paying for the, you know, the electricity, the lab technician, the doctor. It might be $100. You know, you wouldn't have the same sort of tough questions that you face today.
Dean, I have a question about the president's commitment to what he really believes in and what he believes the country believes in. It seems to me as though we were hearing a very, very strong speech from the president yesterday, and yet it is the same president who went along with continuing tax breaks for the wealthy and who was not always front and center on giving us his vision of what health care should look like in this country. What's going on with him? Is this really what he truly believed in? And why didn't he really stand up front and center and fight for all of these democratic principles every day during his first term?
Well, I don't want to be cynical, overly cynical, but, you know, I'd say first and foremost, I have a lot of respect for President Obama, so I'm not singling him out in any way. But first and foremost, President Obama is a politician. And his, you know, I don't doubt he wants to do a lot of things in office and probably many things I'd like, some things I probably wouldn't like. But in any case, you know, he wants to do a lot of things in office. But first and foremost, he wants to get reelected. And, you know, he's got a lot of advisors who are saying, you know, you got to do this, you got to do that. And, you know, he's going to listen to different advisors in different days. He's going to get pushed in different directions. So it doesn't surprise me that if we try and look at what he's done over his, you know, first two and a half years in office, it doesn't always seem consistent because, you know, things are going in different ways and he's responding to that. So he's not always going to do what I want him to do or you or anyone wants him to do. He's going to go in whatever direction seems to make the most sense to him at the time.
Dean Baker, our guest this half hour, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of several books, including Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. Here's our phone number. Thanks, Marion, for your call, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Bill in Madison next. Hi, Bill.
Hello. It seems like a lot of the last hour has been about philosophy, and it seems to me that you know, I have a couple of comments. What I find most offensive about the Republican Party is that they want to reduce absolutely every human activity to a consumer product of some kind that can be packaged and sold in a marketplace. And, you know, I lived in Europe for a while, and unfortunately I did have some serious medical problems that required emergency attention when I was there. And so I got a chance to experience firsthand European-style single-payer health care. And it was explained to me this way, that basically they look upon it like a public utility. It's like water. It's like clean water, public roads, public schools, and it's just one of those things that it's taken off the table as far as being a market-driven thing, because they're seen as basic amenities that any civilized country would have.
Dean.
Well, you know, the fact is that the European countries provide health care, which in most ways is comparable, and you could always look, you know, we do better in this area, they do better in that area, but the bottom line is it's not hugely different in terms of outcomes. They actually live longer than we do as far as that goes, but, you know, let's just call them roughly even. And their cost is less than half as much per person on average, and, you know, everyone's covered. If you look at outcomes, actually, what's really striking is that if you say take the top 20%, richest 20% of our population, they do roughly the same between, you know, the U.S. and Germany and Sweden, whatever country you want to pick over there. When you take the bottom half, there's a huge difference. The bottom half of the European population can count on getting decent care, and that's just not the case in the U.S. And, you know, to my mind, that's a real tragedy because, you know, we're a wealthy country. We should be able to afford that, and everyone should be able to count on decent health care. I agree very much with the caller.
We haven't talked about Medicaid yet. What do you think of Ryan's proposal to give block grants to states who indeed understand their population better and know where the needs are?
I think it's really cynical. I mean, you could always look to areas in which you could say, okay, you know, the governor of Wisconsin or Missouri or whatever state might be has a really good idea, and that means getting some leeway from the federal government. And the government does give waivers on that. So this idea that, you know, you have this one-size-fits-all and everyone has to do exactly the same thing, that's just nonsense. I mean, what Representative Ryan's proposing is reducing the amount that they're going to get, that the states are going to get, by a third. And you're going to have some really innovative governors. You cut what they have by a third, and you tell me that they're going to produce better outcomes? You know, that's pretty cynical in my view.
John from La Crosse, about a minute left. Hi, John.
Hi. I'm a senior nursing student and just about to graduate. I've had multiple clinicals in hospital areas, and in every setting, patients are coming into the hospital sicker and sicker because their deductible from private insurance companies are so high that they're afraid to come in until their life is really in danger. I believe this makes the rate of successful treatment lower and the cost to treat actually more. We don't invest in preventative medicine, and instead the ERs are having to take more and more patients and unable to make that cost. In school, we learn about primary, secondary, and tertiary levels of care, and that the most successful and cost-effective is the primary or prevention. But we are, in the U.S., we're stuck in the reaction or tertiary level. And I think this is driven from the continual rise in insurance costs as the private sector is able, you know, to make business on sick people. And I think that giving vouchers, we don't fix the rising health care costs and, in turn, the economic and financial success of our country.
Dean.
Well, very much to the point. I mean, a lot of people look to this cost sharing, increased deductibles, having people bear a larger portion of their health care costs, and it really ends up giving very perverse incentives, exactly as the caller was suggesting. So people don't see the doctor when they should. And of course, most of our expenses aren't from people going to visit the doctor. It's from when they get sick, they're hospitalized, they require expensive treatment. This is not a way to control cost or a way to give people good care.
Mm-hmm. So, Dean, with such wildly different ideas, what do you anticipate ahead here? Who's going to win?
Well, usually the best guess is muddled through, so my guess is that neither side really wins. And, you know, what we end up doing is we don't see any big changes. We'll see some this or that at the edge, because obviously President Obama's not going to get everything he wants. The Republicans aren't going to get everything they want. So my guess is you'll kind of muddle through, you know, that's not the worst thing, but certainly not the best thing. And what always concerns me is we need more jobs, and I just don't see anything that's going to give that to us now.
Yeah, we need to do a show on jobs again. Well, you're a great guest. Thank you, Dean, so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Thanks. And Kevin was as well. It was a good hour. Thanks to Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Kevin Hassett, senior fellow and director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks to both Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and to Chrissy for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News is coming up, and we have a very interesting hour ahead, so please stay with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.